You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 93. I'm Jessica Quinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about working with tribes as a non-anthropologist. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, treaty lands, the Dene Taw, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Maya Poston on the show. Maya is the tribal liaison and manager of project support for In Context, a small women and minority-owned cultural resources firm located in the Sacramento Valley. Previously, they worked for California State Parks under tribal affairs in the NAGPRA program, where they focused on equitable repatriation. They have a master's in literature with a minor in anthropology from Sacramento State, where they looked at the evolution of myth in the aftermath of Manifest Destiny. So welcome to the show, Maya.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm super excited to have you. I really, really enjoyed the session that you were part of at the American Cultural Resources Association. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have to have Maya on. So glad that we were able to make this happen.
Yeah, that was
a giant surprise.
I think I was given about 12 hours, 18 hours heads up for that panel. So I'm very glad it went over well.
Yeah, you did great. I mean, that was a lot to not be prepared for. So I thought you all did a great job. It was a good, important conversation about the new NAGPRA regulations, in case everyone's wondering what the heck we're talking about. But yeah, so I'm curious. I'm really excited to hear more about your journey because it's a little bit different, it sounds like, from a lot of the other people I've talked to. So I'm really excited to learn more. And to get us started on that, what first got you interested in this type of work?
So my mother is an archaeologist and anthropologist, and I grew up going with her onto excavations, going with her into fields, to field schools, just because when I was younger and when she was still going to school, it was kind of at a point in the archaeology CRM world where childcare wasn't really available or accessible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my father also worked full time. So it was, and daycare is expensive. So it was, you know, okay, well, I have a 6-year-old who likes to dig in the dirt. All right, come on, little 6-year-old, come dig in the dirt. And by dig in the dirt, I mean the dirt piles that they made. It made me feel like I was helping. So I grew up around anthropology. My mom was a really, really big influence on shaping how I look at the world, how I interact with people, and how I view the past and our relationship with it. And so I think I just kind of naturally gravitated toward the ballpark that is anthropology, even though I really, really tried to convince myself that that wasn't the case, as evidenced by my literature degree, which, you know, as you said, ends up looking at myth and ends up being more, less literature and more
anthropology.
Yeah. through the lens of a fiction book, therefore it is literature. But yeah, so I've always been interested in anthropology. And then as I got older, you know, I started reconnecting and looking a lot more into my own heritage and roots. So I'm mixed, I'm Mexican and Native. And so I started paying a lot more attention. Well, no, cut that. As I got older, I wanted to learn more about my culture and about my heritage. And that led me to doing a lot of research and deep dives into the, to put it mildly, inequities that indigenous people across the world face and have faced historically. And so once I got my master's, I kind of realized that I may not necessarily want to work in cultural resources or anthropology or archaeology, but I want to do something to benefit tribes. And so I was, looking at job websites and looking at California State jobs, and I saw a job listing for ARCS's NACRA program, and that was that.
So, okay, I definitely want to go there, but before we go there, I am curious to hear more about your master's and, what that looked like, why Manifest Destiny, all of that.
So, it looked like a chaotic whirlwind until my thesis advisor said that it was clean enough to submit. But my thesis is centered around the novel American Gods, written by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And yeah. And so when I first read it back in 2006, I think, what interested me the most was the concept of backstage that the main character Shadow goes into in a Winnebago, which the novel acknowledges is the RV brand, but it's also a tribe, and there's some overlap and gesturing about what that means in terms of myth and in terms of the, for lack of a better term, the longevity of Native American tribes in the collective consciousness. And so when it came time to write my thesis, I was like, okay, this is my favorite book. I'm going to write on that. But backstage still stuck with me. And so I wanted, after a lot of talking and a lot of reading and a lot of indecisiveness, I realized that the space Gaiman holds for Native American culture heroes, as they're referred to in the novel, is very prominent throughout the novel, but they are very underrepresented in terms of quantity as compared to the Nordic pantheon, which is kind of who the novel all focuses around. And so I started looking at liminal spaces and the concept of liminality and how culture heroes and myth evolved in the United States as a symptom of liminality in liminal spaces. And so the conclusion I came to was that because my interpretation of the novel is Gaiman doing an homage to Americana and how myth functions in the modern age with it, like myth and mythic worship functions in the modern age in the US, the reason why culture heroes are underrepresented and literally are seen predominantly backstage is because of Manifest Destiny. Because you had, these Anglo-Europeans come in, raise, the continent from Maine to California. And so there's very little left. In the aftermath of Manifest Destiny, westward expansion, Andrew Jackson, all of that, you have pockets. And that's what Gaiman is representing with the culture heroes. But also, he acknowledges and he represents the very land of the United States is native and is indigenous, and it's represented through the Buffalo Man throughout the novel. And so it's kind of this these figures take a backstage and are kind of hidden in the wings. However, they are the very foundation upon which this novel is built from a world, from an in-world perspective.
So, okay, if we're talking books, just for a second, have you ever read Gods of Jade and Shadow by Sylvia, wait, is it Moreno Garcia or Garcia Moreno?
Sylvia Moreno Garcia?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I have.
Oh my God, I love that one. Sorry, just we were talking about it and it was, that one came up strong for me because I love it. But anyway, sorry, side notes.
Oh, and then the tie-in with anthropology is liminal spaces and liminality is a concept coined by Victor Turner, who's an anthropologist, and his, I'm probably going to butcher the French pronunciation of this because I don't speak French.
I was going to say, I can't help you there.
The rites de passage. And so like rites of passage. And he has a couple books on liminality and how rites of passage are liminal spaces and just kind of what that means. So I took his writings on that. So the anthropological concept of liminal spaces and turned it into a semi-functional literary theory and applied that to my reading of the novel and also the theoretical foundation for my thesis.
So now I'm curious about how you went from there to the California State Parks position.
I mean, I wrote I combined what I love, what I know with what I'm interested in. And then, you know, like I said, my own journey on kind of reconnecting with my heritage and the research I did with that novel kind of really gave me a hard shift from what I thought I wanted to do as a career into wanting to be a lot more tribal focused. So yeah, I was looking for any jobs having to do with tribal relations, tribal liaison, anything like that. And the state parks job came up for a NAGPRA analyst and I applied and I got the job.
Yay.
Yeah, I'm still surprised that I was that they of everybody that they interviewed that they're like, yeah, we want Maya, but I'm not complaining.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised, but you know, I know it's always harder to see it from the, you know, when it's yourself. But
it's also that I didn't have a lot of experience working with tribes before then. Mm-hmm. Most of my experience up until that point was doing very, very part-time work for In Context, just kind of help with student loans and stuff for grad school, but mostly doing tribal outreach. So no consultations, no, you know, I don't want to say no formal interactions because, you know, if I went out onto a site, you know, I'd talk with the tribal monitors and stuff, but that was kind of the extent of it. So moving from that into formal government to government consultation was, I think that's what surprised me the most of like, oh, if everybody, I don't actually have experience doing this, but I'll learn.
Very few people do though, is the thing. And it's very hard. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I learned once I got started.
Yeah. Yeah. That combination of skills. Yeah. I mean, it's getting more common, but yeah, I mean, it's hard because you can kind of only learn on the job and there's not a ton of positions. I mean, obviously that's changed right now at this particular moment. There's a lot of positions, but
I think it's
tricky.
Yeah, I think it's also, it also has to do with the fields and subfields that a lot of these jobs are posted in. If you're not working for a tribe directly, it's almost always under cultural resources. And so that attracts archaeologists, anthropologists, right. people who, if they don't have direct like tribal consultation experience, then there's a strong likelihood that their understanding of tribal consultation is academic or solely from the legal requirements of, you know, Section 106, NHPA, CEQA, if you're in California. And so it's, that has the potential to lead to a very different type of tribal interactions than I think the NAGPRA world requires.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially it's, as a rare cultural anthropologist within CRM, it's especially archaeology heavy, which, like you're saying, doesn't necessarily set you up much. I think that's changing, but in the past, beyond just what the laws are. But on that note,
yeah,
we are already at our first break point, but we will jump back in and talk about, yeah, what it was like figuring all that out through the California State Parks work when we come back. I want to dive right into the California State Parks position. So when you first started it, you were talking about how you didn't feel like you had the kind of background going into it that you would have liked to have had, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What did you know, I'm just thinking about like other people coming into those positions. How did you learn what you needed to know, and where did you find resources to do that position?
I really wish I could say, oh, you know, it's this website or this book or this, you know, very accessible, influential person that, you know, everybody knows of. It's kind of like what you were saying before the break, though. It's never really that easy, because it's a soft skill set. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a soft skill. So it's not easily or readily taught. It's, in my experience, it's more about what your intentions are and how you want to go about realizing those. And I mean, there are a lot of factors in my experience that play into what I view as successfully navigating tribal consultation. For me, the most important one is active humility.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to accept with grace and without being defensive that 4 out of 5 times, whatever stance you're coming from, you're in the wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, working for state parks, it was, you know, I had to set aside, you know, oh, I am mixed native, for I am a representative of the state government.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a state government that historically has done irreparable harm and
right.
damages. Again, to kind of underplay the history of what happened. But, you know, state sanctioned genocide. Mm-hmm. For decades, arguably continuing into today, depending on certain perspectives. And so it's being able to understand that no matter what your actual end goal is, you need to keep that in mind, that this is what your position is and this is what you are representing. It's mm-hmm. it's not about you, the individual, but it's, you know, I'm representing systemic racism and sanctioned a history of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately the position I need to approach. While I was with the state, that was ultimately the position I needed and the perspective I needed to approach consultation from.
Mm-hmm.
And with the NAGPRA specifically, it was also just having this broader scope of understanding of what NAGPRA consultations. Mm-hmm. Because if you really think about it, it's so messed up and horrific that it feels absurd. I mean, I'm sure if you took away a lot of the identifying features and just kind of explained, you know, oh, well, there's a government that grave robbed and stole the ancestors out of these graves and like all their belongings and held them in a room to be studied and gawked over mm-hmm. for 100 mm-hmm. years. And then their descendants want to, you know, would like to rebury their ancestors, and the state's kind of like, no, you need to go through a process for that. It's like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. But then when you add in the layers of, oh, well, there's the history of anthropology, archaeology in California, there's Al Kroeber, mm-hmm. there's NAGPRA, there's CalNAGPRA, there's all these other contextual layers. And then it's like, oh, well, actually, no, like that makes sense. There's a lot more, I think, unintentional justification. Mm-hmm. But it's still like at the end of the day, my perspective is always, I am representing thieves. Mm-hmm. I am representing red tape to the bare minimum of being able to bury ancestors.
Right.
Of being able to visit ancestors. I'm representing the red tape of, quite frankly, a facet of basic human decency. I'm representing gatekeeping. Yeah. And so with that in mind, there was no way for me to ever go into a consultation expecting to be on equal footing, or, you know, I've seen some people go into tribal consultations wanting to be adversarial from the start and expecting there to be tension, expecting there to be conflict, and going in being ready for that. And so that created the tension, that created the conflict. Right. There's already a lot of tension between tribes and anthropologists and archaeologists. And so that's another layer of humility that I think people in CRM in general need to understand, is that there's history there, and it's not good. It's terrible. And just because, you know, one individual may feel like they're doing better or they're doing it differently or something like that, it's still the weight of your field behind you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for me, what I learned was when I got started was this is how tribes will see you. This is how tribal representatives will see you. And put yourself in their shoes. Difficult to do, frankly. You can kind of grasp concepts, but can't really fully put yourself in their shoes. And it also really helped that my manager is also, or my manager when I first started, is Native, and she's California Native, and had that additional connection and perspective to, you know, be like, hey, so there are just ways that non-Native people will say things, and it's really not okay. This is not how you want to go about it. And hearing it from an outsider perspective, one would think it's completely appropriate to say, you know, certain things, but having the Native, you know, looking at it or being told, you know, by my manager, you know, this is how it's received. It's like, oh, well, okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Why you don't want to say that? Why you don't want to do that? Yeah, unfortunately, it's a lot of learning as you go and being able to accept that you're going to make mistakes. And if you get called out on it, it's because they want to better the relationship with you. It's not because they want you to feel, you know, inadequate or incompetent, but it's, I'm telling you this because I have faith you'll be better.
Yeah. So is there an example of things that people said that they were saying totally innocently that were being received another way? Just trying to think of like examples. So again, for people that are listening, that are going into this type of work, they know not to do those.
Yeah. The big one that I think is unavoidable when you work in the government, state or federal, is the title chief. I know that's, I mean, that's, you know, your mileage may vary on how people respond to it, but some of the feedback I did receive was like, hey, why is this white person's job title chief?
Yeah, right.
Why is this job category chief? Like, there was one instance where I was in a consultation and somebody said that they were pioneering a new approach to tribal consultation. And so it's just one of those moments of like, oh, no, like don't. And so it's common. It's phrases that are otherwise very common in office culture that I think people don't realize have kind of an anti-Indigenous history to them. You know, pioneering, spearheading, on the lowest on the totem pole. Yeah, I heard "circle the wagons" once, and I was like, "Hi, excuse me."
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a couple examples. There's also, I think, a harder one. One that was hard for me to learn was talking too quickly.
Yeah.
Because you generally want to speak. It's speaking slower allows for more comprehension time. It allows more time for the words to settle. And when I get really excited or really passionate about something, I tend to talk very, very, very fast. So that was a hard one for me to learn. It's also, I think, I don't want to say one of the more insidious ones, but it's also telling them no, telling tribal reps no in formal consultation can be really, really tricky, because a lot, in certain cases, it could be seen as denial of their sovereignty, denial of their history. And so it's, you know, instead of a flat out refusal, it's, well, okay, you need to find a middle ground. You know, okay, we can't do this, but I'll look into doing this, and, you know, stuff like that.
So I think first of all, that those were some very helpful specifics for somebody that was new to this type of work. But I also want to get into what kind of work were you doing in general while you were in that position?
I started out as just kind of my position was NACPRA analyst, which meant I did a lot more of like the kind of background administrative work. I was helping with research. I was scheduling the consultations, doing tribal outreach, kind of being the first person tribal reps would talk to when they wanted to have NAGPRA consultations or do a visit. I drafted the NAGPRA notice of inventory completions, notice of intent to repatriate. So I would sit in and participate in tribal consultations, but I started out doing a lot more of the kind of documentation and record keeping aspect of it. And then my manager left after about a year of me working there. And so...
Wow, that was fast. Fast turnaround.
She had been there. She had been there before I got hired.
Yeah. But, yeah, no. But I mean for you.
Yeah, and so I then had to take over leading the NAGPRA consultations and leading repatriations and coordinating with other state agencies, with museums, with universities, and just kind of expanding everything I was doing to more or less overseeing the day-to-day operations of repatriation. It was a lot, but it was, I don't want to say it was fun, because it was extremely stressful. Having to learn as you go, being thrown into the deep end. But in a certain light, it was, I can't think of a better word than fun, but fun is not the correct word. It was encouraging.
Yeah.
I made a decent amount of mistakes. I won't pretend like I didn't. I was new to this. I got, handed a bunch of responsibility all at once, and I was still trying to just kind of figure out how NAGPRA works in the broader scheme of things when this happened. But at the same time, it was never brought to my attention that any of the tribal reps had a complaint about me. They never had any negative things to say about me. If there were, then it was, again, it was never brought to my attention, but it was very encouraging for me to, realize after a while of, okay, I feel like I'm just barely treading water, but the tribes that I'm consulting with, by and large, seem at least amiable with how I'm doing things. So maybe I'm not entirely wrong in how I'm approaching this. So
is there something that happened in that position that you're most proud of, or something that stands out to you from that work?
I mean, I think looking at it solely from a metrics perspective, it would be, what was the, in terms of volume, the largest repatriation I helped with, or, what was the most like emotionally impactful one? It's, you can't quantify that. That's absurd. But for me, I think the most impactful moment for me was we had some tribal representatives doing a site tour of our holding facility, being the California State Parks, it's a repository for all the California state museums across the state. And then there's a section specifically for the ancestor room. And then that's completely separate. And then there's an area for belongings. And so we had some tribal representatives visiting, and we were looking at some of the basketry, and one of the representatives saw their family's design on one of the baskets, which was heartbreaking. It's hard to not cry when I think about it, but we did kind of separated ourselves from the rest of the group, but I got to hear stories about their family and about how their design came to be, what it means, what it represents. And I was able to get that kind of the more intimate context and the history behind the basket. And that's every belonging has a story. Every ancestor has a story. And being trusted enough with that information and being in a position where I'm allowed to learn about that was really, really special to me. The other thing about tribal consultation with NAGPRA is, you know, you also need the perspective of you are asking somebody or multiple people to sit down and openly delve into family and generational trauma. It's the requirements for NAGPRA preclude people to be very open and frank about their trauma and revealing hurts and wounds that have not had a chance to heal. And there's a lot of respect on the non-tribal end that needs to go into that, that there is an implicit level of trust necessitated in that. And betraying that or not respecting that and not keeping that in mind has the potential to ruin everything.
Yeah, that's a powerful moment and quite a spot to end this segment on. But yeah, I'm very excited to come back and hear about how all of this transitioned into the work that you're doing today. So let's talk about your current work with In Context. So what is your position there?
Like you said in the introduction, I'm the tribal liaison and the manager of our project support team, which is kind of a weird way of saying that I manage the project managers. So we have it's like we have the field coordinators and the field directors, and then we have the more admin office end project coordinators, project support. And so I kind of just manage them while also being a project manager.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
The way you said that does not convince me. It's fun.
I mean, this part is off the record, but I got hired as the communication director, and then Trish and I were talking about it, and she's like, actually, you're really good at doing this, and so I kind of want you to do more of this. And I'm like, okay, but that kind of defeats the purpose of my job title being communications director. And she's like, you'll keep the parts of it that I don't want to do. So,
yes.
Which I guess is when you work for your mom, I guess you can't really say no to that.
Yeah, there's that.
That's off the record. Back to what we were saying.
Yes. Okay, so there's the project support side of things. What about the tribal liaison side?
So the tribal liaison side, I haven't really had to delve too much into that since I started. I've only been working here since June of this year. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our work has been contract consultant work. And so the lead agency usually handles the tribal consultation. But so what I've been doing mostly is reaching out to tribal representatives, to tribes, to see if there's any way that we could help them either with capacity building or with like archaeological, like monitor training, or, you know, there are some tribes where a firm or, you know, a government agency will have a project and then ask if the tribe has a preference for who does the survey or stuff like that, and just kind of building connections and relationships with tribes, because Trish has a lot of experience, Trish being my boss and the CEO of InContext, has a lot of experience working with tribes. And so I'm kind of just coming in and picking up that and moving forward with it to kind of, you know, the company wants to move in a direction that's, we're already pretty tribal oriented, but I think there's a want to work more directly with tribes and to be more accessible for tribes. We would like the company, one of the directions that the company moves forward, to be an advocate for tribes. Mm-hmm. I know that in California, there's some conflict, I think, between CRM firms, anthropologists, archaeologists, and tribes. And what I would like for the company is to work to bridge that gap and to show through action and lead by example that this aggrandizing behavior absolutely does not need to exist, and that it's actually very, very possible for the CRM world and the, you know, the academic anthropology, the archaeologist world, like these worlds, to work in tandem with tribes, that there doesn't need to be this antiquated separation of this is science and this is, you know, tribal perspective. It's, again, it's antiquated, it's, you know, anti-indigenous from a certain lens, and it's ridiculous. So I think I'm in a very specific position with my previous work experience to come into the CRM world and say, okay, well, hold on. Your approach is this, and tribes are responding like this. Okay. How about we do this instead? I'm going to do it this way. And if tribes respond more positively, then we move that direction. Which, you know, Trish is 100% on board for.
So obviously I don't want you to throw anybody under the bus. Could you like either paint a picture of kind of what it looks like with the antagonistic side of things and what you're more hoping to move towards, like either kind of a general picture or a specific example? You know, you can obviously not do names, but I feel like it maybe is a different situation in California. So I'd be curious to hear more about like the current situation between CRM firms and tribes and like how you think it could be better, I guess.
Yeah. So yeah, California is, there's a lot with California. Mm-hmm. To speak more broadly, federally, you know, one example would be the ACHP's recent comments about TIPO's tribal consultation, the value of tribal elder, tribal traditional, tribal ecological knowledge. I mean, I can't speak a lot towards it because I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. But there's recent changes to the ACHP that very much devalue tribal knowledge, which kind of, you know, by saying this matters, this perspective matters less than quote unquote, you know, truth, that inherently creates, you know, a sense of superiority, some antagonism, stuff like that. In California, there's CalNAGPRA, which is California's version of NAGPRA. And from that, the recent hot button legislation is AB 389, which directs the California State University system to develop NAGPRA guidelines, NAGPRA policy, and then a policy on research and study, basically prohibiting using ancestors' belongings for the purposes of studying and research, unless with, you know, freely given prior informed consent by potentially affiliated tribes or known tribal, not tribal descendants. Cut that if possible, please. And the language is it's still in draft language, but the language can easily be misinterpreted to, you know, to go into hyperbole, to effectively ban a section of anthropology departments from teaching, which again, it takes a very specific reading of the draft to do that. Looking at it as is, you know, I can very easily see how that is the conclusion some people have come to. Like I said during the conference presentation, though, I think that a lot more comes into play with how universities, because certain California State universities have announced that they are shutting down the anthropology department. And there are some people who are claiming that it is CalNAGPRA's fault, that it is AB 389's fault that this is happening. But to me, that ignores the larger context of, well, there's more taught in an anthropology department than just California Native history. And you also need to look at funding, budget crises, things of that ilk. Like there's a lot more that comes into play with the decision to shut down an entire academic department than one piece of legislation was enacted. And also, I think, speaking more broadly, there's always been some antagonism, I think, from anthropologists toward NAGPRA specifically. You know, you have famously the Kennewick Man and all the lawsuits that came out of that, and, you know, everything that the Army Corps of Engineers did to try and prevent repatriation. You have there are certain professors in different California universities who have come out to be very vocally against NAGPRA, against the concept of repatriation. Others who have come out to say that the way things are going now basically removes all authority from CRM firms, anthropologists, archaeologists, and that, to quote what one person said about how I went about my job at State Parks, bending over backwards to do anything and everything to get a pat on the head from tribes.
How patronizing.
Oh, yeah. It was great. It was great to hear that. Even more great that they never actually reached out to me to talk about their issues. They just... that can be cut. but... yeah, so it's this false dichotomy of quote unquote real science and quote unquote, you know, religion or cultural beliefs or, you know, any other such terminology that people use to inherently devalue tribal perspective and tribal knowledge. You know, and it's wild to me that people still have this stance when it's like, okay, California is on fire 90% of the year. And tribes and tribal elders have been saying, well, if you want to stop the forest fires, you need to do this. They were ignored. And now that they're being listened to, the fires are a lot more manageable. Like, oh, hello.
Yeah.
Maybe they do know what they're talking
about. What?
Like, no. There's a thought. Call the press.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For your reference, if you want to look into the stuff that's Tim White with UC Berkeley and Elizabeth Weiss with Santa Fe State University. Elizabeth Weiss was the big court case. Got a lot of attention.
Okay. Man, okay. Well, I wish we had more time to dive into some of this and, you know, touch back on some of the conversations that were had at the ACRA conference about the new NAGPRA regulations. But sadly, we are already at our time. But I can't wait in the future sometime to have you back on when the tribal liaison program at In Context is even more developed, and you know, some of those conversations that you've been having with tribes have more come to fruition, and we can have you back on as a model for other CRM firms. So hopefully, you know, here in the not too distant future, we'll have that episode. But thank you so much for taking the time. At least you had a little bit more time to prepare for this one than the ACRA session. Yeah. Again, it was so great meeting you in person and getting to chat today. And I hope that we get to chat more in the future.
Yeah, thanks. It was great having me. Thank you so much for reaching out. And for my own job security, I hope that
yes.
the tribal work we want to do here takes off. But also, I would love to be back. Mm-hmm. I would absolutely love that.
Awesome. It's a date.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.